You're listening to WKCR New York and WKCR HD. Today is June 9th, 2026. My name is Eva Cabatas, and I'm joined by Katha Cato, Executive Director and co-founder of the Queens World Film Festival. Over the past 15 years, the festival has become a major platform for independent filmmakers from New York City and all around the world. Beyond the festival itself, Katha has vast experience in producing exciting, innovative programming and has spent over 30 years developing youth and bringing people together via theater, arts, film, and video. I should also mention that I had the incredible opportunity to intern with the Queens World Film Festival in spring 2024, which seems like a long, long time ago, but I'm so excited for today. This conversation means a lot to me. And Katha, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. You know, every once in a while, a young person will come through here and do wonderful things like you did. And I mean, you were so focused. You came in, you knew what you needed to get done. You were really great. And then they go on to so many other wonderful things. And so then to hear from you and to still be part of each other's story is a great reason why we do what we do. So it's great to hear from you, and it's great to be talking.
I mean, I was able to do what I did at the festival because of everything you do. The festival, I think, was an incredible, incredible experience for me and everyone who is a part of it. So
today, that's good to hear. That's great to hear. You know, you were very independent and very focused, and it was really a dream because you were very clear on what you wanted to accomplish, and we were able just to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And it's extraordinary that for a young person at the time, I think you were a senior in high school.
I was, yeah.
Yeah. And it was problem free.
I'm so glad to hear that.
I know. Wasn't that crazy? Wasn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
That's great.
Today, I really want to paint the picture of what Queens World is all about and what you're all about, Katha. So by the end of this, I hope our listeners who are already interested in film and have heard of the festival, I hope they become even more excited by it. And I hope people who are not in the film world at all become suddenly drawn into its madness. So let's get right into it. And before, I guess, we talk about the festival, I want to ask you about your own journey. You've worked in theater, improv, youth arts, and film. I want to know what first drew you to storytelling, and if there was like a particular moment that made you realize film festivals would be such a big part of your life.
That's a huge question, a great question. So the first thing that I think is always surprising to people is I was born in Yuma, Arizona, and I was raised in a very small agricultural town, Brawley, California, in the Imperial Valley, on the inland tip of California. And my parents, you know, my father had been in World War II and he had seen many things. And my mom had come up through those times also. And when they met and fell in love in college, the thing that really connected them was their incredible passion for animals and for agriculture and that way of life and community. And they really instilled that in me. And living in a small town, I think, gives you that opportunity to understand community, both the good and the bad of it, very intimately, over and over and over. And so we were a very small town, and we definitely, you know, there was the rodeo every year. There were all sorts of different things every year that we all gathered and did together as a community. So one of the things about a small town is that, and I really want to be delicate here, is that sometimes small towns keep your secrets. Mm. And my mom struggled, and she struggled with being a mother. She struggled with her emotions and her depression and her impulses, which could be quite explosive. And we lived outside of town, and so I didn't have the most pleasant of upbringing, and we did lots of wonderful things. My parents made sure that we went to San Diego, we went to Los Angeles, we saw movies, we did things, but it was fraught with a lot of explosiveness with my mom, and my dad did the best he could. And I will say that they loved each other so much, but she struggled. One night it was particularly bad, and I was down by the horses. We lived on a piece of property, and there were horses across the road. We lived at the end of Julia Road, and it was kind of funny because Julia Road actually ended a little bit before it even got to us. The asphalt literally ended before you came onto our property. Mm-hmm. And I'm down there, and I'm laying on the back of a horse, literally looking up at the moon and just saying, God, you know, I got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. I got to get out of here. And I don't remember how I made the connection then, but I remember when the thought literally exploded inside my head and it was a bright light. I realized you could see that moon from anywhere in the world. Mm. And I realized then that it would be okay. I could go anywhere I wanted. And I would still see the moon. I would still be me. I would still be connected to the world. I was going to survive this. It was still going to be okay. I'd be able to forgive my parents. Like I could do this. And so as soon as I could, I went to San Diego right after graduation. I mean, literally that night. And I was enrolled in a theater arts program at San Diego State, a Reader's Theater, with the woman who played Peter Pan on Broadway, Mary Martin. And it was magical. Suddenly, I was completely surrounded by people who had this impulse that I did to imagine and to tell stories. And I think my imagination and my ability to tell stories was my coping mechanism to kind of draw, like, let's not get all crazy. Let's imagine, let's talk this. Let's be fun. Let's laugh. And I could be really kind of distracting and entertaining to my mom and things like that. So it was a survival skill. And then when I got to San Diego State, I realized there's a whole world that's based on this. And then I did go to Cal Poly Pomona for in the fall and became a theater major and was just really embraced by a faculty that I think they knew how vulnerable I was. Because most of the people that went to Cal Poly Pomona, this was in La Vergne, California, Montclair, that area in Southern California, like 6 or 7 really huge high schools all around who all knew each other and all had huge theater departments and all did plays and then all went to Cal Poly Pomona. And I came from almost about 200 miles away in a very different deal. And that faculty really embraced me and really supported me. And I was cast in something my freshman year, which was, what a gift. What a gift. Mm-hmm. And I did so much there. And then one day, the Mark Taper Forum sent something called the Improvisational Theater Project to Cal Poly Pomona, which was, it's an agricultural school that just happened to have a really thriving theater department. So this Mark Taper Forum sends this improvisational theater project there. I'm watching it in the theater because we were required to go if a theater major. And I literally stood up during their performance and they were improvising with each other and with the audience. And I stood up and I started to like lean towards the stage. And my friends were like, sit down, you're like acting weird. But I knew what they were doing in a way that I had never known anything about an artistic process ever. I'd always been very lucky with my artistic process. I didn't know that I was an improviser and that I was a skilled improviser because of my survival techniques of reading the room, figuring out what's going on, making it work. Let's get to a positive end. I'll see you later. You know, that was so ingrained in me that I knew what these human beings were doing. They were improvising to make these scenes work and totally invested in each other. So I went to the workshop that they did afterwards, and I knew in my DNA what they were doing. So I start driving into Los Angeles every weekend. I start taking improv classes. Cal Poly and I come to an agreement where I can teach an improvisational performance class, 6 units. I got 6 units. People got 6 units for it. It was very, very rigorous. We put on performances. We did a lot. And I just kept creating and improvising all the way up. I went to the University of Oregon. I convinced them to allow me into the graduate teaching fellowship program for the master's program with an emphasis in improvisational performance, which is unheard of. And I thought I had talked them into it, and they thought they were going to talk me out of it over the course of the 2 years. And then I started an improvisational theater company as a qualifying project for my master's. Mm-hmm. And that group exploded all over campus. We did incredibly well. We started doing cable television. We started doing commercials. We did everything. And then I did a one-woman improvised performance. And in the final defense meeting, you have to defend your process. You have to defend why you should be awarded a master's and of anything. And it came down to where the head of the department asked me this question and said, all right, if we give you a master's in improvisational performance, what does that say about us? Does that say that we're giving you a master's in making stuff up? Mm-hmm. And I said to them, it tells the world, what it says about you is it tells the world that you completely and clearly understand that this is what artists do. We make things up, and that there is a practice to it. There is a technique to it. There is skill to it. There is stagecraft. There is an understanding of movement, the human condition, language, writing, blocking, everything. We're doing it moment to moment to moment. Whereas scripted theater gets 6 to 8 weeks to rehearse it and refine it. We are as legit. We are just as legit. And they awarded me my Master's of Fine Arts with an emphasis in improvisational performance. Now, the group that I had started as my qualifying project had already moved to New York, and they were waiting for me. I moved out here July 10th, I believe it was 1984. And July 11th, we were rehearsing. By the end of September, we had a flyer. We had a gig. And we really did incredibly well for 5 years. We ran till 1989. We just did incredible things. We were the first to do the long form. We were the first to do a Herald in New York City, which is a long form of improvisation, not a game. And then I got cast in a film, and I met Donald Preston Cato. And after the film, I came back to New York, and his financiers were here in New York. He came to New York to try to get that film across the finish line. We became involved. We became involved with each other. We got married in 1989. And then his youngest daughter came to live with us. So for about 5 years, 6 years, we took a vacation from the arts and put his children into New York. A couple of years later, his oldest daughter came to live with us. And so suddenly we were I was the parent of two teenagers, for God's sakes, girls from a divorce. Super fun. It turned out okay. It turned out very well. The youngest one we're very, very close with, and the oldest one is, you know, there's lifelong regrets that will be there on all sides, and not the best of relationship, but, you know, we're still texting, which I take as a victory. So then let's fast forward. When we took the youngest daughter up to college, and on the way home, we started writing a screen adaptation of a film that we of a play that we had purchased the film rights to. We had seen it at the Fringe Festival here in New York. I was directing something that was in the Fringe Festival, and we saw this piece and we bought the film rights to it. And on the way home from taking the youngest one up to college and kind of now, okay, let's get back to what we were doing like 6, 7, 8 years ago. We were full-time artists, and then we got married. The kids came to live with us, and it was their life. We had to be parents. We had to have insurance. We couldn't be gigging artists at all.
Mm.
And so I went to work at Henry Street Settlement. Preston went to work at the investor, the investors, institutional investors. And we had to create a stable life for these two kids that had just come through this divorce and a stepfather, and now in New York with a stepmother. There's a lot. So on the way home, we start writing the film, we shoot the film, we get into a festival. It's a Queens International Film Festival. We win a nice award in the film festival. So we start volunteering for the film festival, and we develop a youth program for them. That was in 86. 89, that festival fell apart. And I have to be super careful because there were lawsuits. People were found guilty of fraud. They were remanded to pay a lot of money and then extradited.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge, colossal embarrassment for the borough, the Queens International Film Festival. You can look it up. It's all there. The names are there, and I can talk about them off camera. I can give you the names. I mean, off, but I can't do it on recording. And it was a heartbreak beyond anything, because all these filmmakers had been, and ourselves included, had been submitting our films, and come to find out that there were less than honorable people doing some very damaging things. And it was quite embarrassing, because by this time I was the director of after school services at camp at Henry Street Settlement, running a major youth program at a festival that was in a local shame on you and a national shame on you.
Wow.
And it was written about in the New York Times, the New York Post, Daily News, Village Voice, Boston Globe, Variety, LA Times, and everything in between.
I can't even
now,
imagine.
It was horrible. Now, our names were never included in any of it, even though we had been very visible volunteers and we were working with youth, their youth program. We were not on the board. And we were interviewed by everybody, and there was just nothing there that we knew. It literally exploded in our faces that last year. So that was 2009. So 2010, Preston and I and two other volunteers decided we're going to do the festival. We're going to do it for 1 year, and we're going to make this right. We're going to clean the slate, everything. The other two volunteers quickly fell away. We kept going. So in the fall of 2010, it actually in August of 2010, the woman who had been the film festival director was arrested in Ulster County on over 45 counts of animal cruelty.
Oh.
Extradited and brought down to Queens, where she was held accountable for fraud. What she had been doing is she hadn't paid all these people, so she went up to Ulster County and she started going to the ASPCA and quote-unquote rescuing animals and trying to sell them. And she was hoarding them in her hotel room. It was beyond sordid and horrible. So Preston he starts going to the to the trial here. And she's found guilty. Everybody gets their money. But we did not get compensated for any of the money that we had put in to save her festival at the last possible moment. To the tune of almost $8,000. Because we were volunteers. We paid for the rent for this theater because she hadn't paid it. We paid for this hotel, but we paid for this advertising because she hadn't paid any of it. And we were stepping up and paying people because people have to be paid. It was pretty bad. It was really horrible. So fall of 2010, we get all the kids that we'd ever worked with through her program. We get the last batch of films. We do a screening. We raise money for Ulster County, for their ASPCA. We send the money that we made that night, the ASPCA, to help them because they only had capacity for 12 animals and they took in almost 50. So we sent them some money. We sent whatever money we made that night. We hired her web designer, scrubbed the website, and started over. And we opened the first Queens World Film Festival in 2011 on March 4th. And we were only going to do it for 1 year. We were just going to make this karma clean. That was all we were going to do. But it was incredible that first year. So many people, so happy, so thankful. Such great audiences, you know, because there was nothing like this in Queens. So we say, okay, we're going to do it for the second year. That was 2012. And it's, again, it was wonderful. It's in Jackson Heights. We're at PS 69. We're at the Renaissance Charter School. Okay, get ready. Get ready.
Oh, no.
Because in 2012, I had a minor stroke. And that was in May. And it took them a year. And we ended up doing then 2013 because people really wanted it. We thought this was a great thing to do and it seemed like it was going to be okay. I was still working, but I was sick. There were some things going on and they couldn't find anything. They couldn't tell what was going on. And then about a month after the festival, I started really not feeling good. And they started really going in and looking for stuff. And then in May, they found a very large tumor. It was feasting on my liver. I like to say it was feasting on pate. And it was big. And it had grown down out of my bile duct. And a week after them discovering it, I had my first surgery. And then away we went. So that was 2013. The last day of chemo, and I named the tumor after the woman who did the festival. Because I thought, you know, maybe if I've absorbed this ugly stuff that she did, and in my effort to make this thing right, I've just absorbed it into my body. And on surgery day, you know, I said, it's moving day. So I go through a big surgery. I do chemo. Last day of chemo, they say, the good news is chemo. You're done with chemo. And I was like, mm-hmm. The bad news is you have thyroid cancer. So away we go. Radiated iodine, thyroidectomy, blah, blah, blah. That takes us into 2014. They're looking at me every week, every month. We do the festival again. Fall of 2014, they say the original cancer has come back. And it's in a place on your liver that we can't do surgery. So we're going to have to do radiation. Super fun. Okay. So we do radiation, 2015. We keep doing the festival because now at this point, I have this community that's pulling for me. I envision myself walking on stage. I envision walking through these different theaters and seeing people there and happy and looking at the screen. I envision it day after day after day. If they told me to eat it, I ate it. If they told me to soak in it, I soaked in it. If they told me to think it, I thought it. If they told me to say it, I say it. If they, I did everything I could do to stay alive. And this festival, this incredible, you've been, you know, it's so vibrant. It's alive. It's a mechanism of itself. And it kept me alive. 2015, I get through 2015 and they start to say, okay, so maybe we can step back a little bit. Maybe we can just start looking at you every 3 or 4 months. 2016, they find a spot on my lung. It's a slow growing spot. It's a very, very slow growing spot. So they keep an eye on it. 2017, we go in and we do surgery on the lung and we get the spot. I was the worst patient. By this time, I was the worst patient anybody had ever had. I really tried hard, but that last one, I was like a cat. I was like a badger in a bag, man. I was so pissed. And I fought my way through and started coming back. And so 2018 was the last time that there was evidence of disease. 19, we start thinking 2020 is your 10-year anniversary, you know. Let's start looking at 2020 as just the celebration to end all celebrations. Let's look at 2020 as, let's get some big donors. Let's go after big people. So we went after Ray Romano. Ray Romano is going to be our honoree that year. And we start going at it. We did a party on two coasts on the same night. There was a party in LA at the same time that we were having a kickoff party in Manhattan. I mean, in Queens. We did a presser in Queens and a presser. We did a presser for the press in Brooklyn. I mean, we were exploding. 2020 on March 19th was supposed to be our opening night. 10th anniversary. Ray Romano. However, on 2013, they told us March 13th, they said, you're going to go to half capacity. And then on March 16th, they said, you are closed. No. And we said, no, we are not. And we were the first festival in the world to jump online in response to the pandemic. And we launched on March 19th, 7:30, Thursday night, standing right over there on our living room with 191 films. And we ran for 11 days and we had over 30,000 views from 31 nations.
That's incredible.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And so then since then, we've bounced all over the calendar. You know, we've been November, we've done April, we've done June, we've done July. But we are now, we're going to open our submissions in July of this year, and then that will allow us to get back to March. And March will either be when we announce who's taking over, or we will say to everybody, this has been an incredible, incredible 17 years. Everybody, raise your glass. Let's have the best party ever. And let's hit play and see what's in the projector. It's an incredible life force. It represents my husband and I. It's everything that's good about he and I. We refuse to give up and we have incredibly good taste and we know how to put on a festival.
I can attest to that, definitely.
So I know I must have talked for like a day and a half, but there it is.
Thank you so much. There's so much beauty and inspiration. I didn't know so many of the Queens International Film Festival, all the news reports, embarrassments. I had no idea, but...
Like, did you look it up? Did you Google it?
I'm going to after this.
Oh, wait, like, till you see.
I'm going to go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, you won't believe it. It's unbelievable. You know, it's a messy planet.
Mm-hmm.
And we all expect everybody to behave. And it's, and when it goes awry, it's very, very difficult. But I think that we can all attest to that when it works and we hit play and everybody's there and the images, whether you like them or not, I don't care. Preston doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
We just want you to experience them. Then it's just magic.
I think the cave speech especially like covers that magic.
It's time to remind you
that since the beginning of time,
we have gathered in darkened caves around the flickering lights to share our stories.
We've upgraded the caves, and the flickering lights are now zeros and ones.
But the impulse to gather remains. And it is in that gathering in the darkness when we all gasp in unison
or laugh in unison or pretend that we're not crying in unison that we remember. They is we, right? Them is us. And I am just another you.
When did you develop the cave speech and like what inspired it?
Well, I've been going through lots of journals, and I do see that I've been fiddling around with us and them, you and me, connectedness since 9/11. Because what shocked me about that whole thing is that there were people that were so invested in the long game of destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because us and them. That was because of othering. That was because of intolerance on every end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been fiddling around with that, but it happened in 2012. You know, we always have a script for opening night. And on opening night, I said to Preston, I'm going to go off script. And he said, what a surprise. And I just started talking about being in the cave with each other and how this was our destiny. And I don't care how much perfume you put on. I don't care about how many buttons you push. We are all longing for that, where you are with your people and your shoulders drop.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter if the story you're telling is something I quote unquote like. It's the magic of being in the room as you tell it, which is the process of living with each other, of experiencing each other, of as a group, you know, improvising moment to moment for the betterment of our group. And I have always longed for those moments, obviously. And then we started refining it and started to fiddle with it. And, you know, some people, I remember like the third year that we said it, there was one woman who had been an alumni and she just started laughing. She's like, oh my God, not the cave speech. And I laughed too. And I was like, yeah, the cave speech.
That's crazy. Laughing at it is crazy.
And she was an alumni who had kept submitting her film to us. So mocking the very ethos of what she wanted to be involved in.
Mm.
But, you know, we don't know how to hold that gracefully because it makes us nervous to want and long for each other that much. So I always looked at it of like, yeah, you just told everybody how bad you want it.
Yeah.
How badly you want to be here with us. And the good thing is, honey, you are. So relax. It's okay. And then we refined it. And then I think in 2021, we got it copyrighted. And I think other people at these events have been saying this also, but we just were able to find a really graceful way to make it resonate with all of us. And I'm very thankful. I get very emotional whenever I say it. It's crazy.
I got emotional listening to it. And I, like, after each screening, I slowly realized, oh, wait, this is, like, every single time. I thought it was just the opening night at first. But it's a good reminder, I think, before each screening.
I think what I'm going to do on opening night, I'm going to say, all right, this is going to be participatory, everybody. So I just want you to fill in the blank. And I'm going to say, from the beginning of.
Yeah, that's perfect.
And see what people say. We have gathered in the darkened
age
around the flickering and lights. See if people say it and yell it out.
It should be like karaoke, like the lyrics on the screen.
That's funny. I want to see, have you been listening? Because whether you know it or not, that's why you're here. That's why you're making these movies. You're literally putting your hand on the wall and saying, do you see what I see? Isn't that beautiful? Or isn't that weird? Or isn't that horrific? Or isn't that scary? Or isn't that whatever? But do you see it too? Yeah. Okay, good. I'm not alone. Good.
I think also the festival being in Queens, like one of the most diverse counties in the United States, that definitely plays like into the importance of the festival. I guess I also wanted to ask how does the Queens art scene differ from like the other boroughs?
You know, that's a really great question because I've been in meetings where people have said, are you, all you cultural organizations in Queens, are you really that close? Yes. Yes, we really are. There's a lot of understanding in Queens of Stone Soup. You know, you have a space. I have a film. You have a projector. I've got the audience. I've got the momos. I've got the dancers. I've got the thing. And it's just great. There's a lot of coming together with that. I've also noticed that this is the most diverse place in the world, but these communities don't like to leave themselves. So a lot of people from Eastern Queens, a lot of people from Southeastern Queens are not going to come to the Museum of the Moving Image. They're not going to come to LIC. They're not. Mm-hmm. And so being able to find organizations that are serving groups out there and then saying, hey, I did a search in our database. I've got four filmmakers who have their zip code is in the same zip code. Do you want to screen something? Do you want to do something? Can we do a thing? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? Okay, great. Let's do it. And then making it happen, you broaden the audiences for the films. You help the audiences connect to what the rest of the borough is experiencing. You just meet more and more people. Even though they're not that far away, the community around the Nepalese center, they're not going to go to Kaufman Astoria Studios.
Mm.
So taking the films to them is so cool. And it's like a built-in audience. And it's just fun. It's really cool. So the programming is important, and how Preston programs the whole festival. We struggle with that. It takes us a long time to figure out how to put all these films together in a way that this community would like to come to them. That this council member would like to promote this block to their district. That this CUNY club would like to meet these filmmakers. And so it's super important. It does make it, I think it makes it more difficult to program, because like a lot of festivals, and it is much simpler, and we're not disparaging them, but you know, they'll do a shorts corner A, shorts corner B, shorts corner C, international shorts, the LGBTQ shorts, horror. And you know how we program, it's very thematic.
Mm-hmm.
Things are grouped together in a very, very different way. And it's all about trying to create these 40 blocks that are unique to themselves and that we can sell to a community or a club or another organization. I love calling up other organizations and say, hey, you want 20 comps? You want a 50% off code? Let's do it.
Did you always organize the films into blocks the way you do now, like from the beginning of the festival?
Yes, he has always done that. And we thought, how hard can this be? It's going to be so fun. But we did say to ourselves over and over, and we said it out loud, nobody else is doing this. So this is very unique. No one else is doing this. Now, festivals are doing that. And you will start to see that they're doing, you know, such and such, five films about such and such. And when it works, it's really cool and fun. And when it doesn't, boy, it's really hard to get a good block together.
Mm. What about filmmaking and how it's changing since, I guess, you've seen it, like, right now, there's streaming services that are so accessible. It's so much easier to watch from home. And with AI even now entering like the creative world, it doesn't seem like it's leaving anytime soon. Do you have hopes or concerns? What are you hearing, I think, from filmmakers right now?
It's really all over the place. There's fear and loathing, and mm-hmm. then there is optimism. And I have been encouraged to see and hear some thought leaders say things like, we better start addressing this and accepting this and get ahead of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know it's a weird analogy, but when they first banned smoking in theaters, everybody went crazy because they said it'll kill the theater.
Oh, wow.
I know, right? You can used to be able to smoke all through movies in public. Crazy.
Yeah.
So then radio, and then television's gonna kill it. Then online is gonna kill it. I still feel that the desire to be together periodically outweighs the convenience of eating your pizza while you're texting your friends, quote unquote, watching a film. Mm. It might become a novelty. And so we will have to embrace that and sell it as such and market it as such. I feel that the coming together is crucial. You know how I feel about that. And you have to be a bigger and louder cheerleader for it now than you've ever had to be before. Some festivals are screening AI and VR work. We do have a young filmmaker that we know, and we have so much respect for her, and she is really embracing VR, and she is rocking, you know, everybody's noticing her, everybody's really celebrating her, and that's great. Will she use that clout to make sure that traditional storytelling has a place at the table in whatever she does? or not. We don't know. It's going to change. It's, you know, older people appreciate story and they make great audiences and they will go to the Museum of the Moving Image. They will go see, you know, a black and white. My hope is that, yeah, we swing all the way into AI and it becomes totally fake as hell. And then it swings back and they'll discover, you know, reality. They'll discover something else. But Arto, I believe, said it, that once we do away with the need for humans to perform, storytelling is going to become magnificent. And he said this decades and decades and decades ago. He wanted all theater to be puppets. Mm. And just take humans out of it. Because they're so flawed, they can never really tell the story. I know, interesting, huh? And they're not as easy to manipulate as images and puppets are. So here we are.
And maybe that's the point, that it's not so easy.
Yeah. I mean, when you're watching something, do you have that moment where you go, oh, it's AI?
Yeah. And then it gets disappointing.
Yeah. Oh, ick.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to start asking people that and take an informal poll and see if I'm alone. When you realize it, do you stay or do you scroll?
It's less impressive, even if it's perfect. It's almost like mistakes are more impressive.
And the whole thing about how AI is going to get smarter than us about it. I mean, 2001 Space Odyssey, it's not like we didn't know. I don't know. I don't know what to tell people on this. Yeah, really? What a shock.
I think it's so good.
The only thing that I think about it, I wonder is like, am I going to be here to see it? Because I think it's going to be easier to live through it if you're 30 than it is if you're 70.
Yeah, I have no idea where we're going, but hopefully that desire to gather really does help us stick together through it all.
You know, the radio is that.
Mm-hmm.
It has always been that. That's a time-honored tradition of gathering around the radio and being there with your others in your group. Yeah, I mean, listening to the radio it's very primal as well. And I admire what you do greatly.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome.
I admire everything you do with the festival and... Right now, you have programming beyond just film screenings. I think poetry events, improv workshops. You have the Being in the Room working session coming up.
Yes.
I wanted to ask about all of that, like how your work goes beyond just the film festival, but all of this stuff too.
Well, recently, recently, all the doctors who have been looking at me for a long time just gave me just great news. You know, everybody is saying that there's no evidence of disease, and whatever anybody is seeing, like a tumor marker or anything, one guy called it reassuringly stable. And I have never been called reassuringly stable in any manifestation of anything I do. So, you know, I'm thrilled. So we decided let's lean into many of the things that for really the last 13, 14 years, because of, you know, the world and because of the dealing with multiple cancers. And once you're no evidence of disease, or once, you know, they stop scanning you every 3 or 4 months, there's many other things that are happening to your body in response to the drugs and the things and the surgery. And so you keep dealing with stuff, and it's the tyranny of illness. And so now that it seems for me that we have a little bit of breathing room and we're past that, we really wanted to do, like, what are all of the things that we want it to do as arts makers and arts leaders, and that we would like to bring to the community, to bring to this community that we've built and that seems to be really expanding. Spoken word and poetry just seems really natural. And also improvisation. I've been doing a lot of improv workshops. I'm going to do another one on the 25th. We're calling them community jams. And if you're improv curious or improv serious, there's room for you in this improv jam. You know, I lead it and we have a great time and away we go. The being in the room is professional development for all arts makers. It's really about, you know, breaking it down. How do you become the best applicant or submitter for any kind of art thing you're trying to enter into, whether it's a festival or an exhibit or your college, it doesn't matter. How do you become the best submitter they've ever seen? Mm-hmm. Second, once accepted, how do you become the best participant they've ever had? Then, how to become the best alumni and remain connected to that organization. And so it's going to be, it's hosted at Flushing Town Hall, the incredible, wonderful Flushing Town Hall. And they're also hosting the poetry this Friday, Prideful Poetry. And it's not an open mic. It's not a slam. It's curated. There are 8 poets. They're each doing 5 minutes. And this work is extraordinarily incredible. We have the 2026 NYC Youth Poet Laureate. We have a human being who is writing a book and is sharing this work with us, who was trafficked. They're trans, and what they bring to the table is this calm acceptance that I've just never seen. Our host for the evening is Avant Garbage, who makes all of their fabulousness out of recycled materials, and I mean fabulousness. And it's something new for us, and I'm so excited, and we want people there so, so much. I encourage everybody, please come to Prideful Poetry Friday night. It's 7 o'clock, door a curtain. We're going to open at 6:30. We're going to have food.
It all sounds really exciting. I think
it's amazing. How did I get so lucky? I don't know.
I think like the transformation, the journey overall, what you've said from the beginning is so awe-inspiringly cool. And how I was also wondering, I thought, was there like a plan, like a step-by-step, a vision, a clear vision? But it seems like life took its turns and like it's a story of perseverance for sure. It's so cool how storytelling like brings you different places.
I appreciate that. The one plan that I consciously knew is that the reason I brought that improvisational theater company from Eugene, Oregon, out of my master's program, because it exploded on campus, as I said, we had so much juice behind us. I wanted to walk into New York with something to offer, something that I could invite everybody to constantly, rather than saying, please like me, please cast me. The minute we were booked, we could start inviting everybody. Everybody that was in the group, everybody was waiters or bartenders, and they could constantly be saying, come see my show, come see my show, come see my show. That was a conscious decision. The guiding principle through the whole thing, I think, has always been, you know, it's a good deal if it's a good deal for everybody. And If you walk away thinking, boy, I really screwed that other guy in that deal, you're going to be sorry. It's going to come. You will pay, and you will be sorry. So it's, you know, for me, I really want it to be a good deal for everybody, so that everybody just feels so great about doing it, because then it becomes better. I can't be the only person in the room who thinks it's a great thing. I got to have everybody think, oh God, this is so cool. I'm so glad I'm doing this. And then that's how you make it be something that no matter where you put your hands on the beast, which is the festival, which is the organization, it, you're feeding the beast and the beast is feeding you. And I think you are an absolute perfect example of that. You came in at a specific time. This is what you're going to do. You know, between us all, we made it happen. And you fed the beast, and you're still feeding the beast, and the beast is still feeding you.
What a nice relationship.
Yes. Yes. It's, you know, because if you don't feed the beast, man, art can be painful.
What advice would you have for young artists who are like looking to take big steps and risks and put themselves out there?
Well, I know it's unpopular, but I'm going to take on the whole situation of being triggered. I learned at a very young age, this planet is tough. And people who look you in the face, tell you they love you, are capable of horrid things. And they are, there's generational brokenness. And I find this planet to be very triggering. And if I allow myself to be triggered constantly, I will not survive it. So I can't be shocked when someone steps right on my hurt part. They have a hurt part. And that hurt part was probably driving what they did. And I can decide not to be around them anymore. I can decide to protect myself. I can decide to make sure that they know that when I see this kind of thing start to happen again, I'm going to step back, but, you know, I'm still invested. You know, I can do all of that. So art is provocative. We don't write plays about the day when nothing happened. We don't make paintings of things that didn't move us. We don't move to things that do not move us. And with all this provocation, with all this stimulation, we're in a hypersense and we bang into each other and we bang into ourselves. And there is a pebble in everybody's shoe. And when we're exhausted and not thinking is when we step on it and it hurts. So part of the stuff that exhausts us is the shockedness and how crazy it all is.
Yeah,
you need to get good with how crazy it is. I'm sorry. Mm. It's not fair. There is nothing fair about it. And it's random and it's hurtful. That's why we tell stories, because we're saying, I'm so hurt by that. Do you see, right? Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, good. I'm not crazy. Right. Okay. All right. I can get through another day because another human being saw me and heard me and said, yeah. No to that little part, but yeah. And that other part, I didn't like at all. I wish you hadn't shown me that. But yeah.
Like you said, it's about coping and growing. Storytelling.
It is. You know, this social-emotional learning situation that has come up and become, you know, there's a misunderstanding. Social-emotional competency is not about the absence of excessive or emotional roller coaster and hurts. Social emotional competency is the ability to navigate it and survive it without bloodying each other up too much. And the ability to, when you have, you need to be equipped then with what it takes to heal that and put that back together. You can most things if you come to do that. And you can't come to do that from a shocked place that it's happening. And I wish I could say that I have that firmly in place at all times. Right now, I'm navigating something that that grew out of my shockedness that it was happening. And if I had not been shocked at the moment, I'll bet you we would all navigated it better. And the fallout's still happening. And I'll bet you it comes back to haunt me again and again. But that's what art's for now. I can write some poetry about it. I can scream into the wind. I can stumble into the cave and say, anybody ever seen that happen before? So my long-winded advice is that hurt part, that's where your truth and your incredible insight is going to come from, because of your knowledge of that hurt. And that's what's going to bind you to others. So don't be shocked when it hurts.